I'm going to try to go through some of the just the key aspects of the global events right now, just to set the pace for Pascal and the class he's going to be giving on the elusive tensor, which we've been reading so much about lately. And I thought I would start this this meeting by emphasizing that, well, I'm sure everyone here knows that on Saturday, LaRouche is going to be having an international webcast, right? Up in Finland. So we're going to have two screenings at the office here. And everyone should just spread the word, try and maybe even bring people. We're going to play it at 12:30 and at 7. And we want to really pack this place in to get everyone to listen to LaRouche's next strategic assessment. Because as we know, he's been doing this for a number of years. And this plays a huge dominant role. Maybe not on the surface, like it's tough to see. Sometimes LaRouche says something and then, you know, the world just says, oh, thank you, LaRouche, never really happens. It's that what happens when the media is controlled. But over the many years that LaRouche has been fighting consistently and giving these international presentations, he's developed a reputation, which is the type of reputation you generally want to have in politics, which is being right all the time, consistently. And not just calling things as being things which will happen, but rather pushing forth a solution at every stage. And so as a strategic thinker, especially over the last 3 years, since this, well, 2 years since this economic collapse has really fully just hit the world and beyond, the world has been paying extra attention. For example, LaRouche just came back very recently from speaking at the Italian Parliament with a group of senators who have been allied with him for many, many years. People like the finance minister, Giulio Tremonti, who has done many conferences with LaRouche, many ministers within, like Petrolini, who has a mimic of our New Bretton Woods policy inside of Europe, have been encouraging Lin increasingly and giving him as many platforms to organize the leadership of Europe and of the world behind the necessary ideas of what needs to occur. Like several months ago, when the Bretton Woods was just being discussed, coming out of, well, first you had it coming out of Britain, you know, the British government saying, you know, we need a new Bretton Woods. Then other people have a different version of the Bretton Woods, and you realize that, like, everybody has a different idea of what the Bretton Woods means. Obviously, the imperial version of it is not at all what LaRouche has been discussing, though LaRouche is the guy who's been bringing this to the table now since 1994 as a necessary new economic system to replace the dead globalization. So he had spoken in front of the European Parliament back in, was it December? He's back there in Italy again. And he just recently, I believe he came back, right, to America at this point, probably. And then the power behind what he's getting at is that there's a method of looking at processes not as they are right now, but as they will become. By understanding the conditions that are being set forth by a current series of decisions, you will know the general dynamic and be able to forecast accurately what's going to occur in politics, in life and economics and everything. And this began really taking off in July 25th when LaRouche forecast the general breakdown of the world economy. And this is 3 days before anybody even heard of what a subprime mortgage was in the general population. Then all of a sudden, a week goes by and all these hedge funds start freaking out that there's this unpayable toxic waste that they'll never be able to pay off, and that's sinking them. And this ends up being the leverage which blows up the world, the entire world economy. Now, LaRouche also immediately pushed the HBPA as uniquely the only solution globally to deal with this collapse by putting the banking system through bankruptcy reorganization, declaring Chapter 11, and having nation states move in to save the people, essentially, put up a firewall. April 11th, this year, Obama, who we were supporting to a degree because he was coming out saying all these nice things about Lincoln and Roosevelt and we wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt, ends up officially rejecting all of the good serious thinkers around him, like Paul Volcker and others, who were in a communication with us. Lin comes out on his April 11th webcast and basically denounces Obama because he's now covered with these fascists, these behaviorists, and develops the fact that this guy has got a very unmanageable Nero complex, or manageable if you're an oligarch around him. Because this is really what's being manipulated in shaping the current policies of the U.S. Now, these types of insights have been taken onto by people within every government to use as ammunition, because not everybody wants this world to go to hell. A lot of people are now realizing that it's either, maybe they've played the rules of the game for a very long time. They capitulated some principles, but I mean, now that this thing is actually coming down, they're realizing that the question is either the survival of their society, their, you know, or better ideas than what they've been trained to think, you know, than what's surrounding them. So Lynn has been pointing out that, okay, the key thing that we're addressing is not, and this is involved with any flank that we have, be it between the Nero Obama, the fact that Obama is now pushing, you know, totally fascist Nazi policies towards his own population as a solution to the economic collapse, but that any assessment that we're making isn't against any particular policy as such, but against the governing principle, which is controlling how all of these parts manifest. Right. And to understand the current situation, you are not a strategic thinker if you don't understand that the real principle driving everything right now is this insane bloodthirst, this obsession on the part of the British Empire, this grouping of inbred financiers, to destroy and undo the Renaissance, the Peace of Westphalia, and the creation of the modern sovereign nation state system as it was conceived and implemented to create peace in Europe after the 30 Years' War, and that formed the modern basis, in effect, of current international law, of national governments respecting the borders and sovereignty of each other and working for the benefit of the other as the basic principle of world affairs. And most importantly, to undo the American Revolution and the dynamic that set forth in the explosion of the power of the human mind, the increase of freedom, political freedom, creativity, that exploded in the universe at that point because of these breakthroughs. And this was carried forth by manifest in every great leader, from Abraham Lincoln to Franklin Roosevelt to John F. Kennedy, who kept on pushing this principle of real real charity in the sense of loving your fellow man and doing everything in your potential to support to defend the freedom of every human being. So now, this driving the events that we're currently seeing, this intention, because that's what we're seeing with human societies, is an intention, which is the question of what we have to ask ourselves when we think, well, what is causing things that occur in my senses to arise as they do? And it's manifesting most clearly right now, not just in what Obama's doing, which I'll get through, but with things like these conferences, like we've had now 3 weeks ago in Montreal, like called the Adapting to a New World Order conference, sponsored by the IMF, you know, or its sister conference in Essen, that was occurring at the same time on global depopulation, asking, you know, with certain conference titles like, is an ecologically friendly world possible to enforce in a democratic society, or, you know, with the implicit, what's not said is, you know, do we need totalitarian states to enforce the types of destruction of living standards, of quality of life that a society under a green economy is going to have to adopt? So you got these thoroughly fascist intentions who are laying the blame for the world economic crisis, who are trying to make an argument, create a false argument that the cause for all these things is just, you know, nation states you know, that are greedy. They, like, use their resources. You know, they have, like, interests. Or individual human beings who are also greedy by nature. And who are just overpopulated, you know. If we didn't have these things, these problems, then, hey, things would be chipper. If total peace on Earth, if we just had some sort of a replacement for these things. Right. So we know that what they're talking about is not exactly a shift towards the dynamic that John F. Kennedy or Franklin Roosevelt were thinking about when they were discussing peace on Earth. But one of the problems is you have this idea being sold to the population, and people are actually buying this bullshit because largely we're rooted in a very sensual state of society. Our identities, everything from every part of our culture, from the music, the arts, the science, everything is rooted in a very sensuous idea that's the route to knowledge. It's just by accessing your senses, feeling one way or another. That's the most you can know is how you feel from moment to moment. Right? So this is historically, when you look at it, this is rooted in what was always known by the founding fathers as a grave threat to civilization, as British empiricism. Right. So you have this idea of pretty much every idea that tends to come out of Britain tends to, except for maybe Shakespeare and a few others, tends to be pretty shaky in regards to this empiricist question. But there's the thinking of people like John Locke, of Descartes, of Isaac Newton, that say, you know, that mankind accesses knowledge through impressions of our senses, or through recollection of those impressions that our senses took in. And that's it, you know. So try to prove that the Earth is not in the center of the solar system with that outlook. It's just not going to occur. But this is the population right now, and this is how people are basing their entire worldviews, their priorities, their decisions from day to day. They're not bad people, but their method of thinking is really stuck in this shadow world. So what we got to do is get people to actually challenge themselves to face the question, which is what's actually behind the shadows? What's generating these shadows that you're seeing? You know, what is the physical principle? And in a time of crisis, there's this poet Shelley who wrote in a piece that Lynn references all the time. It's an essay called In Defense of Poetry. Have you guys had a chance to read it? I know you two definitely have, right? You guys know? Well, have you read In Defense of Poetry? By Shelley? Percy Shelley? No?
No.
Okay. We should maybe read that this weekend. It's about 20 pages. But Shelley makes the point that in a time of deep crises, great profound changes, the potential to affect great changes between in society are increased exponentially. Right? The ability for mankind to receive and communicate very profound and necessary ideas respecting man and nature, as Shelley puts it, is increased when you have a point of deep tension in a political or in history, right? And it's the Declaration of Independence gets this point across very well, that the founding fathers understood this, because you read the thing, and immediately the second sentence on the Declaration points out that it's well known that that mankind will suffer many evils willfully as long as they can be suffered, as long as they're... No, I actually probably have it here somewhere. I actually wrote it down. I wasn't planning on reading this just now, but whatever. Where it reads, Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. Right. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. So, there's a certain understanding that you had to, that the abuses of the British government, that they were enforcing an economic terrorism upon the American people, as well as the Canadian people, who didn't quite move in that revolutionary direction at that period, was so unbearable that these the minority of leadership, the small grouping of maybe 0.4%, people like Benjamin Franklin, Hamilton, and the actual solid leadership of the revolution, they realized that it was now or never. You had to capitalize on these moments. Don't come around every day, you know. So what we're getting people to do is to shake themselves out of the world that they're holding on to. There's a certain level of comfort that they think they have, that they're willing to, people will hold on for quite some time. But yet what we know is that this crisis is going to get very, very much worse than it is right now. And we need to prepare people right now to understand that which they will come to want to know very soon as the pain sets in. Because we are on the verge of hyperinflation right now. And we can know this scientifically, which, you know, we're all working towards right now. So, you know, we're out there on the street. We've got our flanks, our signs, our pamphlets with Barack Obama with a little Hitler stash, you know, and every single provocative image you could possibly pull out, challenging people to see if this is actually true. Can they actually, like, do their own mind? Can they allow their own minds to work to the extent that they could find out on their own if what we're saying is true? Or are they so attached to their emotions that they're not willing to look a little deeper? And here's a guy, you know, here's an example. You got a president, Barack Obama, right? Looks nothing like George Bush, totally different skin color, and, you know, speaks well, much better. But he's coming out attacking doctors who are offering too much health care, you know, right now. He's quoting surveys that are saying, well, from places like the Dartmouth Institute and others that have been longtime pushers of euthanasia and kill the old. But he's pulling out surveys or studies by these assholes, proving somehow statistically that more care equals less health. You know, he's actually using these types of studies. So you got a president who's obviously not representing the interest of anybody, and it's, well, not the citizens at least. And people tend to still hold on to this emotional reaction, this emotional image of something that they've been sold. And that's what you get in the street, is generally two types of reactions. Is of the emotional type of people who will either just come out in some form of rage, like we've all been experiencing now for a week or so with these signs, which is, you know, totally really irrational, since they'll walk away in most cases without even taking a pamphlet to see if they actually can go on the website and verify this or not, because it was never about truth. Or people who are engaging in an intellectual act, who actually are very, very, have either been having these types of thoughts, or at least want to know why it is that we're saying something which is totally unpopular. Nobody else right now in the world is saying anything other than the fact, or at least not in popular media, that this guy's anything other than a messiah. Yeah. So, or at least, you know, a combination of the messiah and maybe JFK or Martin Luther King and maybe FDR. Rolled up into one, like, homogenous superhero. So you get these reactions, and that's the honest type. People will actually, in this case, these are the types of people who we're going to have to recruit, who already are searching, and they're willing to actually engage upon an intellectual commitment towards seeing if their opinions match up to reality. Can they make a discovery that changes them? Because discoveries tend to have that effect. Luckily enough for us. And so soon people begin to realize, I mean, we've encountered this enough, that, you know, the opinions that Obama is just like FDR, you know, he's spending money just like FDR, you know, that he's saving industry. You know, he's giving money to GM. He's bailing out the banks, buying up toxic waste. He's using more government, right? He's talking about taking the power away from those evil HMOs, these health maintenance organizations in the states, which are, they really are evil, but he's talking about more government authority, right? He's talking about creating jobs just like FDR did, you know, green jobs, pushing carbon cap policies so we can get rid of industries, that, you know, like a bill that Pelosi's pushing right now that might pass as of Friday. So, you know, he's pushing these things. Wait a minute, but didn't FDR create more industries? Didn't, you know, is this actually what FDR did? Did he just spend money? And people are beginning to realize that this type of thinking that's been sold to us and is not at all what Obama represents. He hasn't really done anything that's significantly different from anything George Bush did, no matter how much he tries to spin it himself or others try to spin it for him. You know. So, to understand fully why this is completely BS, I figured what I would do very quickly would be to take you guys through just certain things about these HMOs that a lot of people, especially Canadians, don't really know that much about. Like, I don't know, do you guys know fully what an HMO is and how it works? So? Basically? Okay. Well, to just go through quickly as a concept, because what most people need to understand fully here, well, the reason why they're playing the game, if anything, on the street, or why they accept, you know, they'll give the answer like, at least he's not George Bush or something until we snap him out of it, is that they don't have a proper conception of what a government is, what the role of governments fully are. So it's like they're more willing, as long as they don't have that idea, they're much more willing to play a game with certain fixed choices that will, in effect, kill you. So that's not really if you're a real human being and you consider yourself free, then it wouldn't make much sense to select an option which keeps your ability to act in a creative way, or you wouldn't select an option which will only result in destroying your future. But people capitulate, and they'll say things like, "Oh, aren't politicians corrupt anyhow?" Or that's just the way things are. You know, you just gotta play, you gotta vote. That's all you can do. Hope you get the least of all evils, the least corrupt or something. But that's not the case. Because if you actually have an idea, if you've made a discovery, you know that governments originally were created the way that this Declaration of Independence, that with that idea, that spirit of protecting people and not working for profit, you get a sense of how most things that are currently being destroyed, like the healthcare system, were created in the first place. Because if something was created, or something is being destroyed by a certain mode of thinking or a certain type of policy, it's fair to say that that type of policy was not the same when these things were built. Right? Makes sense. So you look back, and between the 40s, between 45 and really 70, 71, you had essentially a structure of a global economy that was founded upon the principle that nations and governments of the world existed for, not, like I said, not for profit, but for the protection of stability and to encourage the growth of human life, of quality of life. And during this period, things like in the U.S. you had the Hill-Burton Act, that was a government-sponsored medical insurance program for all citizens. So it doesn't matter who you were, but you would be insured as a citizen with a single government-sponsored program. You had certain concepts that your health, your infrastructure, water, you know, were inalienable rights. It's not something you should necessarily make crazy profits off of. And so you also had a certain necessary mechanism that was put forth by Roosevelt's after the Bretton Woods, of fixed exchange rates, stable currencies, that allowed the necessary investments towards these not so immediately profitable sectors like building sanitation systems or increasing your research and development in your hospitals or, you know, producing more doctors or hospitals. These things don't make a lot of money right away, but the necessary mechanisms were there. Hey, how's it going? Cool. That's right. So you did have necessary mechanisms like this Bretton Woods system with its fixed exchange rates that allowed for the long-term low-interest type investments into your society, into building up your the basis of your physical economy and increasing not just the powers of labor but the powers of the mind of individuals who want to be entrepreneurs, who want to, you know, have something for their families or contribute something to their communities and produce a product. And if you invested in that period, in that system, your investment was largely going to go towards something which is going to benefit people through a new technology or, some product was going to be produced. It wasn't a gambling. It wasn't a casino. That's not how it operated. So that system produced a certain effect, and we were just getting these reports about how infectious diseases were being completely wiped out. Like at the turn of the century, you had something like 750 cases, or out of 100,000 deaths, about 758 of which were caused by infectious diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, something like that. By the 1970s to 80s, because of this massive improvement in your basic sanitation systems, investments into research and development, the Apollo mission produced, MRIs, CT scans, nuclear medicine, amazing things. That number of 758 was reduced down to a 40 people per 100,000 whose deaths were caused by infectious diseases in the U.S.
What was the number before?
758.
Over
100,000 deaths? That's how many were caused by infectious diseases. So you had something like all as well, 4.6 hospital beds per 1,000 human beings in every part of, especially America, but these stats are reflected as well in Canada at that time. So 4.6 beds. Today, this is 1970, 1980. Today, this is down to 2.6 across the board mostly. The number of deaths per 100,000 of infectious diseases is today, you'd think, science advanced, things must be getting better. It's actually 60 now, 60 per 100,000. So we've got a 50% increase in infectious disease deaths, and that doesn't include things like AIDS, which wasn't really known at the time of that statistic. And AIDS, it's obviously much more than 60 per. But so you have this complete dismantling of the quality of healthcare that human beings, that citizens today receive in the current system. And the reason for that was, when Nixon did come in, and as a lot of you know, he came in, floated the dollar, and you had the ideology of a drug pusher known as Milton Friedman, who's totally economic British liberal ideas in economics, essentially made everything totally free markets, money for everything. Everything that anybody does, be it health, be it whatever, doctor, policeman, you name it, it should be subject to the free markets. You should be able to make a profit off of whatever. So that type of thinking that took over our textbooks, took over our policymaking, this type of conception, which is totally anti-American in every way, it goes against the Constitution, it goes against everything that humanity has stood for in progressing forward. This conception allowed the complete deregulation of things like industries, the regulation that FDR put forth to keep these financial predators in check was dismantled. The fixed exchange rates that prohibited people like George Soros or these other multinational speculators that destroy African nations or Asian nations by manufacturing depressions. You know, you just gamble on their currencies, buy a lot, sell short, destroy their currency if they're not behaving, and then bring them back into globalization as cheap labor. These types of methods of economic terrorism, which were stopped by FDR's policies, were thus opened once again on the world. So that was in 1971, where you had this shift under Nixon, who was a complete mess, one of the worst tools. And it was under that idea that you could privatize everything, and things like public works were now up for making a profit off of, that you were able to institute things like the HMO Act to replace the Hilburton Act, that gave these private insurance firms the ability to just grow and basically make profit off of insuring people's medical coverage. And they would get their contracts through the companies that would employ, that at that time were still employing a lot of industrial workers, you know, farmers. You actually had real jobs back then. Today, these HMOs, they do largely exist. Like, when people do say nice things about Obama because he's taken the power away from HMOs to decide who gets to live or die, they're not wrong because HMOs are good, because HMOs really are evil as sin, but they're wrong because what Obama's thinking about replacing them with is more, even more evil, which is actually what I'll get to. But it's this idea of having a new state-controlled body that determines with a certain body of experts who gets to live or die is what this new MedPAC law is being fought for by people like Tom Daschle and other fanatics who are saying, you know, you need something that looks like the Federal Reserve but to operate for healthcare, with a body of experts that decides, you know, who gets to live and die. I'll get into how that works, but this is much more sick because it is coming from the government, which is not supposed to be. Again, this is not governments are not profit-based. This is not why you have them. So when you officially do, you're looking directly at what Mussolini was doing, what Hitler was doing when they privatized everything and had the government serve as an enforcer for private interests. So that type of relationship between government and corporations, or these private financiers, is what we are talking about when we do say fascism. It can take on many forms, but that's it. So now that this is a whole new phase space, the world hasn't seen this yet, not least since we stopped Hitler, or at least maybe you've seen in Argentina and other test cases in the 70s, but in terms of America, you know, Europe or Canada, or mainly America, this has not been the case. So what we saw there in the U.S., as the dismantling, like we saw with the hospital beds and the diseases and other things, resulted today in a completely dysfunctional system where 50 million Americans don't have access to healthcare. That's true. So if you do get sick and you don't, let's say you're not employed or you just can't afford health insurance, I mean, you either just have to, you know, stitch yourself up, which happens a lot, or, you know, wait to die and hope for the best, or meditate or something, you know? Think happy thoughts. Because the emergency rooms in the U.S. will shut you out if you don't have insurance. It happens all the time. So God knows how many millions of people have already died because of these HMO laws. But it's also had an effect upon other nations, too. Like Canada, at that period, you used to have a lot of the investments, when things became a profit-based system, a lot of the investments into building hospitals, training qualified healthcare physicians, and investment into medical technologies totally began to drop off. To the point today where a lot of Canadians have to either, you know, it's nice that there's certain good principles about our universal healthcare system, which we should save and build up again. But you do have a lot of Canadians who do have to go completely bankrupt just to go to the U.S. and get heart treatment immediately, or else they die, or get a new organ and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars in some cases. Whereas if they stayed here, they would have to be put on either an infinitely long waiting list or they just wouldn't get it. So, you know, there is this effect internationally that's a product of these policies. So yeah, these things do kill people. But Obama, and this is another thing to tell people, because I've been coming across this a lot, people will support Obama with the arguments that, one, He's putting government controls. He's taking the decision to die from the, or who will die from the HMO, the private financier, or the private bank, insurance company that's already owned largely by these same banks that are receiving these bailouts. To at this scale, it's about $14 trillion in the United States. So these banks that are getting the bailouts own the HMOs. The HMOs take up about 30 to 50% of the cost of overhead, unlike, you know, Canada or as it was beforehand, where it was maybe 2%. So if you were really going to cut somewhere, you'd cut in those things. But people are saying, well, you know, he's putting government controls to decide things, you know, as he creates a universal healthcare system. He's taking their power away somehow. And yeah, and they don't even, it's important to get people to think about the fact that he's not just creating a universal healthcare system, because that's what they're sold, where they're getting like better quality care, you know, but less of it, so-called. But he's also chopping off almost $1 trillion in healthcare payments, like government-sponsored, you know, Medicare, Medicaid financing, gone. That means $200 billion to hospitals that serve the poor that will die if they don't get treatment. These hospitals that have been receiving tax exemptions and other incentives to stay alive are going to be cut off. Things like, well, what Obama's pushing now with this idea of, MedPAC, right, as the so-called, yes, replacement for them, as a government institution that functions like the Federal Reserve. This thing, well, one, is actually saving the HMOs, because you already have a huge unemployment rating. Okay. Like 1 million people, or 5 million people have already lost their jobs in 18 months. So since these people only have insurance because they have jobs, now don't. So the contracts to the HMOs is drying out, meaning what happens to the HMOs? Right? No contracts, no money, no business, you collapse. So with the massive unemployment, which has hit something like, the real unemployment's like 16.8% or something ridiculously high in the US. It's similar in Canada as well. These, at that rate of the disintegration of the physical economy, these HMOs would have collapsed. So what he's doing is he's not erasing their power and he's not getting rid of their existence or anything like that. He's giving them more contracts by giving, yes, it's called the universal healthcare coverage, but the problem is, and people are beginning to pick up on this because of what we've been putting out, is that it's modeled off of Britain's healthcare program. And if you're in Britain and you're over 65 and you get heart disease and need treatment to stay alive, go out and make your will. You know? Or if you're young and chronically ill, and it costs a lot of money over the year to keep you alive with your chronic illness, no matter what age you are, like, get comfy with looking, you know, shopping in a cemetery. You know what? Sucks to be you. So the reason for that is that NICE, which we've been attacking and exposing, I mean, our function right now has been to really just blow the top off of these operations and the fact that these are completely modeled off of Hitler's T4 programs of selective killing of your population based upon cost effectiveness, or like how much money is a human being worth, you know, put a dollar value next to it and then figure out if the medication that they're getting costs too much relative to their value as a human being, and have that serve as the standard of whether or not they get to live or die. That type of thing is the root of the national NICE, the National Institute of Healthcare Excellence. That's it. That's this international organization that we've been just attacking profusely and exposing at every single seminar and everything else. But this is the model that Obama and many governments in Europe now are also being duped into following. So the way it works with NICE is they'll say, yeah, if you break your leg or you get like, you poked your eye or something with a fork, yeah, you'll get coverage. Everybody will get coverage, okay? So those 50 million Americans will now get it. Everybody gets it. But you have a cap. There's like a limitation. So if you need some sort of a treatment that costs over, well, in Britain it's like between $20,000 and $26,000. That's the cap per person. So you just won't get it based upon that cost. And there's about three different categories of age brackets, you know, between like 15 to 25, 25 to 40, 40 to above, that have slightly different standards. So if you're, again, if you don't know, you're 60 or something, you're really out of luck. If you have a lot of money, if you're rich, you can go to another nation or something and pay for it yourself. But that's what MedPAC would function as. Now, as it stands, and this is the organization, so-called, that would be government-owned or government-run. Recently, you had the, also I just point out that you had the director of NICE, who was forced to defend himself from all of our attacks on the Hastings Center website, and his name was Anthony Collier, and he actually just totally incriminated himself. It was pretty good. And the Hastings Center, by the way, this is a very long-term organization that finances bioethics, which is essentially find reasons to let people die. They've got a 30-year history of doing this. It's pretty disgusting. But right on their website, it says here, the cost-effectiveness criterion NICE uses, the cost-effectiveness criterion NICE uses is that only technologies expected to generate a quality-adjusted year of life at a cost less than a threshold of $20,000 to $30,000 will be recommended. Then he asks, our recent attacks on some NICE decisions, NICE, it's not so nice, decisions, evidence of some deep unrest? And then he replies to himself, it is inevitable that on occasion there will be clashes. It is also inevitable that the value judgments that determine, among other things, the value to be placed on small extensions of not very satisfactory life are contestable. So, I mean, right there, he's just incriminating himself in the fact that, you know, he's advocating putting value, price value, on human life. Right? That's pretty sick. And all of Obama's advisors are total adherents and followers of this ideology. And we actually came out last night, or was it yesterday morning or last night, at one of these conferences, and pointed out to one of the collaborators of this fellow, I wrote his name down, the Alliance for Health Reform, another offshoot of this controlled by the Rockefellers. He was confronted by one of our members, one of our youth members, Michelle, on the fact that this speaker had advocated many times that he couldn't imagine wanting to live if you're over 80 years old, you know, as a justification for his crazy policies. Right? If you're 80, why would you? Probably can't even, like, enjoy sex anymore and stuff. Why would you want to live? Who knows what these people are thinking? But she came up and confronted him with the fact that Benjamin Franklin was in his late 80s when he organized the Constitutional Convention. You know? If he actually got his way, then he wouldn't have had a nation that he would have been living in. There was also an older lady at I think it was the same conference, I think, who was 105 years old, and she was spunky. She got up and asked, this is at the town hall meeting that Obama had, right? Yeah. It was good because Obama never really answers questions that aren't controlled in a totally controlled environment. But in this case, it was a controlled town hall environment, but to show you how enraged the population is, who are beginning to really see through what this thing's about, you had three pretty intense questions thrown at Obama that exposed him and it put him on the spot. One of them was by a 105-year-old lady who gets up and her daughter was there? Okay, her daughter represented her. But she points out that when she was 99 years old, the doctor said, you know, if you don't get a pacemaker, you're dead. And the woman was like, bring it on. Let's do it. I want to live. So they hugely expensive operation, right? Give her the pacemaker. Now she's 105, spunky, life, you know, I mean, and confronted them, like, what you're advocating would essentially kill my grandmother. Are you, you know? And Obama just tippy-toed, and he had similar questions like that coming from a guy whose mother was on who had intensive cancer, and she was he just said, you know, I she's a human being. She wants to live. She's, you know, she brings joy to the family. I believe that she should deserve the best healthcare that our technology can provide her. And he's fighting to keep his mom alive, essentially. There's millions of people in the situation, and there's going to be more, especially as the baby boomer generation all goes into retirement and gets old. But Obama just, again, you know, answered with, "That's a great question," and then didn't say anything. Yeah. There's something he said about his grandmother. I forget. You guys remember what? Obama, yeah, they were asking him, like, well, what do you, oh, no, that was Katie Couric in this interview on ABC. Yeah, they asked Obama, like, well, this interview, you got him on the spot and asked him if he thinks, what is it, that, or would he do this to his own family or something? Would he keep his own family alive? Or would he not want the best treatment for his family? And it was in reference to, I think, this comedy made on his grandmother who needed hip replacement surgery. And he's like, well, I wouldn't expect the government to pay for it, but I paid for it out of my own pocket, of course, because it's my grandmother. It's like, well, if you expect it out of yours, wouldn't you want it for everybody? And again, it was a pretty intense question that he totally dodged. But it's exposing to the world that, you know, this is not really a good idea. So again, we're not attacking Obama, though. We want him to change, and we do have a policy right now coming out of the Homeowners Bank Protection Act in the United States that's still active. It's been passed in 6 states and 180-plus cities, and there's still a fight being waged at the highest levels to implement this thing and have the government go back to its original functions in protecting people, put the whole thing through receivership, save pensions, keep stability. And this legislation is the only thing in the world right now that comes anywhere close to offering a potential for a global recovery. Everything else is just shit. So this fight is being waged, and what we're doing now is to make sure that we can surround Obama with those individuals like Eric Holder and others who were same people in discussion with us very, very quickly and implement that which everyone knows has to happen. Everyone in every state and every state legislature and the federal government has been getting their asses kicked by us every day of the week for 2 years on the subject. So they do all know that it's this or nothing. So the overall idea is that this is not what we're attacking. We're not attacking Obama as such. We're not attacking when we have a picture of him with the Hitler stash. We are attacking the policy, but our real enemy here is this intention of the British Empire that we went through at the beginning, right, to undo the Renaissance, undo the American Revolution, everything in between, go back to a dark age where you have feudalism. You know, a few born to the right family, the right inbred gene pool, get to dominate the world, and everybody else gets to be a little, mind-fucked cyber monkey. That's just a ridiculous system with windmills everywhere. So that idea, that intention that's governing all of the unfolding of the processes, we have to see now in the context of what's going on in the world. Now, globally, right now, yes, we have this, but we also have an accelerating food production collapse that's been happening because of the economic collapse. You have an FAO report, the Food and Agricultural Organization report of June 19th, just came out pointing out that there has been an 11% increase over last year of the people who go hungry every day in the world. So now it's up to 1.1 billion of the world go to bed hungry every day. Right? There's way more than that live off of less than $1.50 a day. But that's like verge of starvation. So that's been increasing. And they break it down, right, to which regions of the world. You could look at any map at night and it's just, you know, you could see which regions are developed and which ones are dying because there's just no light at a night sky. You know, the view of the globe at night. It's just Africa's black.
What's the number for the people dying
from there? Well, now it's 1.1 billion. In Asia and the Pacific, it's 642 million. The Sub-Saharan Africa is 265 million. Latin America is 53 million. The Near East and North Africa is 42 million. And even in the developed countries, is 15 million. And so again, internationally, this has waken up a lot of collaborators that we've had, both dormant and otherwise, since the 70s. This movement has been fighting for doubling world food production. And Helga Zepp, LaRouche's wife, is one of the leaders across Europe and Asia for our campaign that has the support of world leaders. I mean, read the petition list, it's huge, for doubling world food production right now. And we can do that. We have the technology to do that. It's just a question of political will. And people are getting pretty pissed, so their will is kind of, like, globally right now, there's about eight, of all of the bailouts that have happened in all the banks since the collapse has begun, $18 trillion has gone towards bailing out banks. Right? Of that, that's nine times more money that's gone to development, like third world development, in the last 49 years. Not even 1 year. That's 49 years. That's nine times more than all of that combined. So, again, this is really enraging a lot of people. And the contraction as well of productivity at this point is devastating. China's lost 29% of their imports, exports since the collapse really began to hit. So everybody talking about how China's going to be the next takeover economy after the U.S. collapses is talking out of their ass, because 900 million of them are complete rural poor. That's the way that they've sort of gotten there, this illusion of having money, because who else produces for our dollar stores? So their capacity to sustain, they're already impoverished 900 billion rural poor workers who are all like low technology, agricultural, uneducated, low quality of life, is being dismantled. Argentina has lost 50% of its grain production this year. You've got Russia, across the board, they've just lost production in everything, even including their raw materials, which is what they've been surviving off of since Russia essentially collapsed. All of their industries have been hollowed out, and now that they're kind of like Canada is. We exist off of the money we make from exporting raw materials cheap. So they got their natural gas and some other things. We got our water, lumber, you know, natural gas ourselves. But aside from our service economies in our main cities, that's all we do. We don't really produce very much at all. So Russia's lost, on average, about 26% of its production, its productive capacities. And this is like this. There's not a single nation that's really escaped this at all. So in light of this, I thought maybe we'd remind ourselves that the oligarchy, this is their objective. This is the exact opposite of everything that LaRouche stands for, but which gets at this question of relative population density, which you guys somewhat know something about. This is Bertrand Russell. He's a guy who won a Nobel Prize, big celebrity in liberal schools everywhere. And this is a famous quote that we quote profusely, especially now that it's so appropriate, because you do have a flu pandemic hitting the world. Meanwhile, we're shutting down our capacity to finance medicine and beds. To get across just this intention. Now, he's also the founder of the entire Cold War strategy of mutually assured destruction came from this guy, and he was a longtime advocate of world government bombing Russia to have the world submit to a one world government back in the 1946 period, which is pretty ballsy at that point. And he's very open, you know. If you actually want to see what the intention is, you could just read him and know that he was also an active in politically. But this is a quote from his Impact of Science and Society, which I think we'll quote many times from the next couple of days, that will horrify anybody. Somebody want to read that?
Yeah, read it.
Sure. Oops. Just read aloud.
At present, the population of the world is increasing at about 50,000 per diem. War so far has had no very great effect on this increase, which continued throughout each of the world wars. Wars has hitherto been disappointing in this respect, but perhaps bacteriological war may prove more effective. If a black death could spread throughout the world once in every generation, survivors could procreate freely without making the world too full. This state of the affairs might be somewhat unpleasant, but what of it?
Lovely man. So, we don't have any direct evidence as of this point that this new swine flu, H1N1, is actually a tool for depopulation. But we know the intention of what's governing society right now. And even as Lynn was asked in one of his recent webcasts, if you have the evidence, like your neighborhood's burning down and you know there's a pyromaniac loose, you know who they are, it's a fair chance to say it's not an accident. If you're asking why is my neighborhood burning. Now, besides that, there's a responsibility that governments have when a disease like this flu becomes level 6. This is about as high as you're going to get. It's a global pandemic. They're already losing control of it in rural areas of China. Britain hasn't been reporting it because they've been trying to suppress it now for a long time. So they've been reporting their own the cases that they have in their nation. And now it's come out as of yesterday that they've totally lost control. They don't know how many there are. So they just, it's liberal. And in fact, even the British, I believe it was the foreign minister, forget, one of the ministers of Britain stopped Margaret Chan, who's the director of the World Health Organization, from making this level 6 for like 3 weeks. Right. All because in his mind, what his argument was it's unnecessary. It'll just make people scared, and it would disturb the free markets and tourism. Free markets and tourism. So now,
that putting it at level 6 would prevent
tourism from make so much money. So, Britain has been playing uniquely a very active role in keeping the world from doing anything about this. And at this point, I think France is pretty much the only nation that's made any signs that they're actually preparing for increasing their vaccines, increasing hospital beds. Like, they've got a plan to make 7.6 hospital beds in a very short period of time per 1,000 people, which is a necessary thing. Governments should be doing this sort of thing. But in every other part of the world, you've got this sort of nonchalant, let devil may care attitude. Like, let's just keep happy thoughts and cover your mouth when you cough. That's generally the federal policy for Canada and the U.S. I think actually the U.S. you had the health czarina, forgot her name, the woman who's in charge of a lot of the health policies, went on Sesame Street, I think, and gave students a little lesson on how to always cover your mouth, wash your hands. That was like a limitation. So, yeah, it's kind of lacking sanity. So, all right, yeah. Who was the question?
Oh, well, I was just wondering, do you actually think that spike was a real threat, though?
Yeah, it's killed quite a few people, and it's going out of control. Yeah.
So I heard that in Quebec, only one woman died from it, and she was 65 years old and had pneumonia.
Mm-hmm. Actually, no, that's not true. We've had already about 3 deaths in a very short period of time, and most of which are... The interesting thing with this strain is that it's killing most people between 15 and 20. It's kind of like the Spanish flu of the 1918 period that killed something like... what was it? How many millions of people died from that globally? More than the war.
Tens of millions.
How many?
Well,
I think it was 30 million.
Not sure, because the population was like world population.
Yeah, it was like 5%.
A billion.
Yeah, it was like 5 or 10% of the world population.
Yeah.
Or it was like 100 million, I heard, or something. That was my figure. But the thing is, that was pretty much the only strain which we have any record of having specifically targeted people like our age. Usually these things do go for old people or the very, very, very young. But, yeah. You even had one of the ministers of the Philippines just recently died from it as well. So the entire Philippine parliament has been shut down. They're closing down schools. Mexico's been hit the hardest. I mean, it's really targeted these South American...
Kid. There was some reports about the mutation.
That's why I went to level 6, I think, because it started going... It behaved differently all of a sudden. And it's not flu season either. That's another key aspect of this thing, is that there's flu seasons, right? Different parts of the world have different flu seasons. This one is breaking all the rules of any flu. So it's still, even though flu seasons have ended in most places, it's still just getting harder and harder. Like, it's just growing.
Well, I think it's fair to say even when people die, sometimes it might not be confirmed that it was from the flu.
Right, like in Britain, they didn't confirm anybody. They only registered something like 600 people because they were trying to keep it hush-hush, like, or try to act like it, you know, my house is burning, but maybe if I just pretend things are fine, fire will go away. They were playing that attitude. And so... they have so many people there who they just don't understand. And also, in rural regions, it spreads much. It's a headache because you don't know. Like in a city, you can sort of create a quarantine. You can control these things better. Like SARS, you're able to quarantine it more in city environments. So that's where they were able to shut it down before it did become crazy. But now it's in all of the rural regions, which you can't control, especially in regions like Asia. People just don't know. So it's very difficult to think about for a lot of these governments, but serious global coordination needs to occur with sovereign nations working together. And this gets to, even though bacteriological war is, I mean, Bertrand Russell gets a hard on over this idea of it being the greatest thing to solve overpopulation and just, you know, bring us back down to the caveman. Hey, how's it going? What time? They didn't throw out the idea of war. It's been disappointing, perhaps, only killing 58,000 per diem, but it's still a very important aspect of empire. And so, you know, you look at what other effects in this aspect is occurring globally, and, you know, you've got the Iranian elections that are on the verge of heading towards civil war. I mean, the Iranian elections, they had problems with that already. There was already shadiness occurring. But you had an attempt to... And it was actually moving in a pretty good direction to bring some sort of stability and order. It's not as bad. Actually, it was never as bad as the media was letting on our side, like in Europe and in Canada. The media is largely creating a... it's being used to coordinate a certain idea of chaos to just manipulate the population. Like, we had huge protests all across René Lévesque by, you know, hundreds of local Montrealers and Iranians with, you know, where's my vote, all with the green colors, kind of like these colored revolutions, protesting down. And you've got a real, like, ferment in the population. And this is being used largely to cultivate the environment, or create an environment where civil war will become possible in Iran. And there's an ongoing attempt by the British to use their Sykes-Picot type of ideology, both in Israel, in the entire Middle East region that they've controlled for a long time, to just blow the place up. So this is being used to provoke and overflood into Iraq, into Afghanistan, into Pakistan, which all of them are completely destable. Right. Even now you have 100 people that just died in Iraq because of the a suicide or a couple of suicide bombings that have mostly focused on the Shia population at that period, which affects the whole government interaction, which was dealing pretty calmly with Iran for some time, and Iran's been actively offering a lot of help in bringing some sort of peace and training police forces in Iraq. So you had collaboration occurring, which is now being just lit on fire. So that whole region is completely being provoked by the British, and we know it's the British because Iran has been, I mean, the foreign minister came out actively attacking Britain. They just kicked out two British diplomats. They called back their Iranian ambassador from Britain because they have enough evidence to point out that Britain is the one financing the terrorists. They even captured a couple of people from the Mujahideen something, I forget, Al-Khalq, who admitted that they were trained by the British, and they were giving information, basically being told to blow shit up and send reports back to their contacts in London to give to, like, Dateline and all the other, like, British media and other global media. So this guy, the foreign minister Mwataki has been attacking Britain on this point profusely.
I saw, by the way, saw on CNN that the minister from the British Foreign Office,
David Miliband, whatever.
Yeah. And he was giving like his 2 cents about the whole issue to American media.
Mm-hmm.
And I also heard that Iran had blasted the British media for misrepresenting the situation.
Yeah, for sure. They even blasted. Well, Tony Blair got caught on an interview where he was asked, like, why is it, do you think that the foreign minister is, and Iran is accusing Britain of having created this whole mess. And the whole time, he was just trying to, like, pass Britain off as, you know, like, I think it's just, you know, they've got a grudge from, and he didn't want to say, like, us overthrowing Mossadegh in the 1950s, probably. You know, he kind of had to keep on stopping himself. They have a grudge from our screwing them over forever. but he finally just said, I don't know, they have a grudge. And he kept on trying to like shift the blame to America. He's like, well, if they were going to blame anybody, they would probably blame America, but that's crazy, because, you know. So he's trying to like make Britain sound like this liberal, innocent little bystander. But we know that they've been provoking shit across the Sudan, across India, the world right now is being manipulated crazily. And Bertrand Russell's philosophy of war as a means of not just population control, but I mean, this is the mouthpiece of the methodology of empire, is to keep your enemies killing each other, thus they can never actually have 2 seconds to think about who's really controlling them to group to destroy their enemy, which is this parasitical slime mold that LaRouche points out as this, you know, today it's the British Empire, yesterday it was the Venetian Empire, before that it was Rome. But the point being, this ideology is, it has a, there's a certain evil principle to this thing that has to, it can only be wiped out with knowledge. Like, people have to be informed and they have to understand what's controlling them. Because all of us come from a culture, whether we, you know, it wasn't really our choice to be born, but we were born and we're in this culture that has formed our identities around a very, like I said at the beginning, a very sensuous, sense experience based sense of reality. So our sense of reality, our ideas of who we are, what's important, how we think, our methods are shaped by something which is very twisted. And what we got to do is look back when you're in such a position. The only thing you can do, because human beings aren't animals and animals don't have a history, they can't look back to, you know, the continuity of what cows came before, you know, generations before, and learn from them. But we got to see what ideas and what principles governed mankind's development over history, and find the best aspects of those concepts in science, in philosophy, in politics, in everything, and rigorously work them through. Like, never be lazy with ourselves, but to really work through to develop not just memorized, I know this fact and this fact so I can, you know, win it at Jeopardy, but really make them our own so that we actually become something that we'll confidently tell other people, hey, you want a solution? Like, we're fighting here. We're serious people. We can actually, you know, we can bring you up to our level as a good teacher might think of himself, not just enforcing, like, data on the students, but to actually want to help students make discoveries and become better. And we all have to sort of develop this sense of in ourselves as we increasingly try to communicate new knowledge to people, because that's what society needs. It's historically, it's contagious. It works. It works very well. But, you know, we all subjectively have to make certain commitments to do these types of, to do these things. And LaRouche has put forth a means. Like, it's nice to have ideals. It's super necessary to have ideals, because that's what tends to govern the universe, but you want a means to achieve them. So in terms of thinking through what is physical economics, the science of physical economy, the science of increasing your population density and quality of life, what is the human mind as a source of value in a society, these are questions which, well, I mean, you know, we're all trying to battle with day in, day out, but it's really vital. Especially when you consider what potentials there are for anybody who's seen some of the videos that we have on the future of Africa and other things. I mean, a great shift can happen very quickly in this world with the right set of discussions occurring between Russia, China, India, who are not totally controlled by these financiers. A shift in America coming from the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act bill in Canada, from what we can possibly, you know, bring in terms of our knowledge of Canadian history, of the Bank of Canada, of our role as a nation in the context of a community of nations to build up and recover from destroying ourselves in the past 40 years. These decisions now that unfold, the decisions that we make now will be affecting and moving the world, you know, years from now. And that's actually what LaRouche has called for, is, you know, a real economic system is based upon a 50-year outlook. You're always thinking about three generations ahead and what you're doing now as having that type of effect. So you want to increase, because we can do things that affect things immediately in the immediate surrounding space-time that we can see empirically. Sometimes it's more satisfying to do things that way, but nothing really good ever occurred by, you know, give a couple of bucks to a bum or something, it might make you feel nice, but global unemployment's still, you know, going crazy and shit, so we have to deal with that. I think that's pretty much, I hope that sets the tone for what you were going to go through regarding this question of the tensor a little bit. Do you guys have any questions or anything about what I went through at all? No, not as far as I can see. Maybe there's more fish in Alaska or something. I don't know. But no, they're actually going through a big problem where they're killing their cattle in like all of the milk farmers right now. Like the prices of milk have plummeted to such an extent that farmers can't, like milk farmers, dairy farmers, globally just can't stay in business. So
why is the price of milk plummeting?
It's the nature of the markets. I mean, the way these markets fluctuate is everything's done for profit. So if you have a futures market where you just bet on what the price of something's going to be in the future, and you bet low, and you get everybody else to bet low, the price becomes low. So if the cost of your production of whatever is X, or it's like, you know, $30, and now the price is all of a sudden only it costs maybe like $5,000 per cow, you know, and a certain amount of production. But if your money that you make for your product is less than the cost of production, you're in the red. You're just gonna. So these guys are just killing their cows immediately, selling the meat. And that's in South America. That's everywhere. Which again, in the face of a global food crisis, is crazy. Because.
L'exemple est peut-être pas le meilleur exemple parce que c'est quand même connu qu'ils jettent des quantités énormes de lait. Vous avez une surproduction.
Maybe that's why the prices are low, because you can have maybe so much milk that the quantity, the surplus, creates a low quantity. Never mind the fact that nobody's, you know, huge amounts of people aren't actually getting the milk who need it, but the price becomes so low. That's actually why they paid a bunch of Canadian farmers in like 2008 to kill all their pigs. Like the Canadian government went in and paid farmers $50 million to just kill your pigs, because the markets were glutted with pig. So it's like, see, the idea of the oligarchy of an imperial or a money system versus a credit system, like what we're talking about is a Hamiltonian credit system as the means by which you're going to recover from this type of crisis. A money system is based upon government serving as an appendage to serve the free markets. So that's how the governments act in accordance to keep the markets, whatever, however the freedom of the markets, whatever it desires. Whereas a credit system, it's the government that plays the active role in stabilizing currencies, in creating, building projects and other things. So, yeah. We good?